Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Coach's Corner. I'm Coach Andrew Poretz from Ingenuity Coaching. I help people discover and fulfill their passions and greatness. My mission is to inspire and challenge you to dream big dreams. And with my coaching, manifest those dreams into reality. You can visit my website at myfuturecoach.com and follow me on Twitter at Coach Andrew. If you're listening live and you have a question, you want to participate, the phone number here is 646-929-2893. You'll be able to listen to the show on the phone, and if you press the number 1, I'll know you have a question. And we also have a live chat room right on the show page where you can also feel free to participate. My guest tonight is Gretchen Reinhagen. Next up, in fact, in my series of conversations with cabaret pop musicians, Gretchen is a multi-award-winning artist, receiving the coveted Triple Crown of Cabaret Awards in 2010, the Nightlife Award, the Bistro Award, and the Mac Award. As both a singer and an actress, she's performed in a broad range of theaters and concert halls, from the House of Blues in New Orleans to the Assembly Rooms in Edinburgh, Scotland, to professional theater credits, including Janis Joplin and Beehive, Louise Sigar, and always Patsy Cline, Domina, in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the narrator in Joseph in the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and the lead role of the therapist in the premiere of Mother Me Therapy at the world-famous Cherry Lane Theater in New York. And with no further ado, because I'm tired of the ado, Gretchen, are you with me?
I am. How are you?
I am good. I am good. And where are you tonight?
Me.
Oh, my pleasure.
I'm actually, I just finished up working, and I am home, calling from home.
Okay, and where is home for you?
Home is uptown Manhattan, Washington Heights.
I did not know that. So I could probably see you from my window.
Oh, where are you at?
I'm up near Columbia Presbyterian.
Okay, we're not too far from there.
That's
so,
pretty funny. Here
yeah.
I thought you were in Brooklyn or something. You seem like a Brooklyn kind of guy.
I did start in Brooklyn when I first moved to the city many years ago, and I moved out because I wanted a bigger place, and Brooklyn was becoming so trendy. I couldn't get a bigger space for what I could afford in Brooklyn, and at the time, Washington Heights was still very affordable. So got an apartment, about 3 times the size of the one I had in Brooklyn.
Mm.
And that was really what, it was hard. I loved Brooklyn. I gotta say, I loved living in Brooklyn. So it was a big move for me.
And Brooklyn, when I moved into Manhattan, Brooklyn, a lot of Brooklyn was a place you wouldn't go to.
Right,
you
sure.
You couldn't get a cab driver.
Right.
Even to what we now call the good parts. Maybe they'd go to Brooklyn Heights.
Right.
They thought they might see Dr. Huxtable there or something.
Right. I used to always wait until I got in the car and closed the door before I would tell them where I was going.
Well, that makes you a real New Yorker, because that is how we do it here. Because we know, don't say, excuse me, would you be willing to drive me to the worst part of New York City?
That's right. Especially when we first apartment was out in Midwoods, it's almost all the way to Coney Island. You know, and it's like you tell them you're going, you want to take Ocean Parkway, like they roll down their window and you tell them, and it's like they just, they zoom away as fast as they can.
You didn't try saying, but Woody Allen
went
to school here? That might have helped.
Nobody was in the mood to drive out there. So you had to be crafty.
Yeah. So, anyway, I'm glad you're you're here in Upper Manhattan, where it's another cool world. I don't care what anyone says.
It really is. It has grown on me quite a bit, and I love living up here. And
that
it's constantly
beautiful park.
Changing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what we need up here, don't you? We need some rooms for people like you.
Oh yeah. You know, there's some rooms kind of far. There's certainly some stuff on the Upper West Side, and then there's a room, and I'm blanking, it's like on 110th or 116th, somewhere in there. And that's about as far up as I know.
Yeah, and that's, really like below Columbia even. So,
we
don't have anything, there's nothing up in the Heights and Inwood, and lots of happening places are happening up here, and so I think probably that's going to be around the corner is some
I
sort of a
think
room.
So. I mean, there are some pubs in the neighborhood that were trying live music at different times, and yeah, I think you might be right. Maybe it's just a matter of time, because it's certainly an artist filled neighborhood for sure.
Well, we can go from below 54 to way above 54.
Way above 54. That's
yeah.
right.
That's what I think we'll call it.
I like that. That works out. And you know, I mean, we had a Starbucks, so that was always the sign. It was, you know, you could move in.
Yeah, when I got a Starbucks right downstairs, I said, I finally, I've made it. Looks like, you know, I've made
That's
it
right.
after all, like as Mary Tyler Moore would say. Very exciting for me. I can, you know, let a bucket down and with a note, latte, please. And
that's right. That's right. They should actually start that. That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. It would be, you know, and I'm sure there's an app for that.
There probably is.
Yes.
There probably is.
So let's try to get serious if we possibly can.
All
and,
right.
And it's okay if we don't, because I enjoy this.
All
but,
right. Whatever.
So you have you know I didn't really talk about your whole background here because I didn't want to do a 5-minute introduction, but you actually have a very interesting history, and I know that you've done teaching and you've done a few things before
yeah.
you found your way to where you are now, and I'd like to hear a little
to
bit about that.
Big city, yeah. I my dad is a singer, and he sang in the clubs when I was very young. He had a band in the 60s and 70s, he had a couple different bands, and that was really his thing. And then he kind of stopped that probably by the time, I want to say by like the mid to late 70s, he stopped playing with the bands, but they were always involved in theater. He was a music educator. My mom's whole family was, her dad was a music educator. That's, you know, they were all in education in some form or another. So that was kind of the day job. And but they stayed involved in community theater. And so by the time I really started getting involved, I had a fair amount of outlets and was encouraged to do all that stuff. So I was kind of always either doing a show or making music in some form or fashion.
Mm-hmm.
From the time I was very young, and when I got older and found my way to college, and I landed I wasn't really sure if I wanted to go the theater route and or the music route, and I ended up at Pepperdine in the music department and a bigger scholarship, so that made it an easy choice.
Right.
But I really kind of always thought of myself more as a music major, but again, the opportunities to still do theater and other things existed, so I continued, and I was performance major, wasn't really planning to teach, but after college, kind of the first, I was given an opportunity to teach elementary and eventually high school as well, music. And I did that for a number of years before I said, okay, I need to kind of get back on track of what I was doing and give this a shot. So, you know, packed my bags and headed to New York, and I think I've been here about, I want to say 17 years now.
That's
what I counted recently, which is kind of crazy to me.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, and just, you know, certainly was doing theater when I first came. I think a lot of people come to New York for that purpose and found opportunities to do that. Ended up kind of also needing some various day jobs, and I'd always loved cabaret, and that was something that I could continue to do and still have my day job and sing every night. And that's, you know, I sort of found my way into the cabaret world where I think I'm probably most at home over the last, I don't even know how many years now. Maybe close to 10.
And you're actually leading me to an area already that I want to ask you about is.
Sure.
What is cabaret? And when I ask you a question, it may not be because I need the answer, but I'm asking on behalf of whoever's listening.
Sure.
So what makes cabaret versus another type of entertainment?
I've heard so many different definitions. It is not, you know, like the movie or the Broadway show. It is not, there's no pole dancing involved. I know sometimes, you know, I don't know what people have their various definitions of what cabaret is.
And by the way, you had a little break there
had...
while you were speaking. There was a little break.
Oh.
And did you mention the show Cabaret?
Yeah, I mean, it's not. It's people have their sort of idea of what it might be.
Right.
And that show is certainly probably something that kind of forms those ideas. I think a lot of people think of it in a different way. The best way I can describe it
mm-hmm.
is there is. It's a live performance in a small and intimate space. I think it's the room that kind of defines it. There is no fourth wall. It is just you as yourself, not
right.
playing a character per se. It is just you up there in a room. And what I think is kind of special about Cabaret is it's really an intimate experience. As I said, there's no fourth wall, but unlike a big concert venue, your audience has a chance to sit, you know, just a few feet away from you in a
sure.
room where they're maybe only sharing with an audience of some rooms, 40 and to 100 people,
mm-hmm.
Depending on the size of the room. And there's that communication that happens between the audience and the performer that I think, for me, it's what defines the art form. That and there's a freedom to create and communicate a lyric in sort of a myriad of ways that you take it in and that you understand it and what it means to you. I think that's a huge part of it. I think that can certainly be done on a concert stage.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've seen artists that handle both venues very well and are very similar regardless of what venue they're performing in. But yeah, it's that intimacy for me that really kind of defines it. People used to define it, I think, by a particular period of music. A lot of people would talk about the Great American Songbook,
sure.
and which is anything from you know, the Tin Pan Alley era up through
mm-hmm.
the early 60s. But I think that what it has become today is much broader than that. I think artists performing today would feel it's broader.
Sure.
Yeah.
A few years back, I mentioned this on the last show I did. A few years back, I got to take a master performance class with Marilyn
right.
May, who is...
Oh, yeah, she's amazing.
You know, she's in her late 80s and still...
Yes.
She's like female Tony Bennett. She is still
yes.
powerful, strong, teaching, singing, performing.
Absolutely.
And it was very, very exciting. And... one of the things that she said that had really stood out for me was she was talking about this, and she goes, Cabaret. I didn't know about Cabaret. I worked nightclubs.
Right.
That was her word.
Right.
And it's sort of a, both a different time, but also like I think it evokes a like when I hear nightclub, I hear a different thing than when I hear Cabaret.
Sure. And I think that's true for a lot of people. But I think what we think of as Cabaret now is certainly what, when we think back to sort of the era of the great supper clubs like the Bon Soir,
mm-hmm.
these were rooms, you know, and even the Oak Room that closed not so long ago, these really were sort of what I consider the cabaret rooms of their day. But yes, they're certainly called night, and many people will still, you know, refer to them as nightclub acts. And I think it's just kind of what your preferred vernacular is and how you see them.
Mm-hmm. Now if I were to lend you my time machine,
mm-hmm.
which is, it's in the shop, but it'll be back last Tuesday.
Terrific. I will borrow
yeah.
it. Sure.
So if I were to lend it to you, what club, cabaret, nightclub, you name it, do you wish you could go back into time and do a show?
I would probably have to say the Bon Soir or the Blue Angel, but yeah, there's something about that, and you know, and I'm also a huge Kay Ballard fan, and that was sort of the room where she got her start, and to be able to be a part of that, you know, the time and that club would be pretty amazing to me. Yeah, I would definitely be fine taking a trip there.
Nice. Well, I'll see if I could, you know, I'll make an arrangement if I possibly can.
I'm not even sure what it is now. I feel like I I looked it up. I was trying to find sort of the original address. I think it's like a real estate office or something. I don't know. Gone the way of so many.
A lot of things, like the
addresses.
Paramount Theater is an office building. And,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It'd be changed. It's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But it's okay, Ballard. Is she one of your biggest influences?
Oh, I think so, for sure. For sure, because she introduced so much more music than people even realize. You know, I mean, she was the first person to ever record Fly Me the Moon. People think of her, people who know her, they know her from a couple of things. She certainly made, you know, a gazillion television appearances, the show, The Tonight Show, all of those shows for quite some time. She was on the Perry Como show as a cast member for a long time. And then a lot of people know her from the Mothers-in-Law sitcom that she did.
And that's the first thing, by the way, which it shows you how that I'm not 29 after all. But it's the first thing when I think of her, I remember that TV show.
The Mothers-in-Law.
Yeah.
A lot of people do. And which I think is what sort of gained her biggest amount of fame kind of across the board. New York cabaret lovers that have been around quite some time, and Broadway lovers are certainly familiar with her nightclub career, and she played every club there was. And she's, you know, done a fair amount. She got her start on Broadway and in the club. You know, she did Lazy Afternoon is from the Golden Apple, so she was the first person to sing that. And that was in 54, and it put her on the cover of Life magazine. So that was, you know, that was a big, that's a huge part of her career, and that's the part of her career that probably influences me the most. What resonates with me is that she is still this incredible comedian, yet with this wonderful voice that, while she certainly sang a lot of funny and wonderful session material, you know, her rendition of songs like Maybe This Time or My Man, are gut-wrenching and incredible. So that's certainly, she's absolutely one of my biggest influences, for sure.
And on who are some others?
I have such a kind of eclectic mix. As I've gotten older, it's changed. When I was younger, of course, I was a huge Streisand fan. And I think she was a really big influence for me as a teenager in particular. A family member turned me on to Sarah Vaughan, and I remember just listening to recording after recording of her and just being in love with that voice. And I think as I got older, when I moved to New York, for sure, and you started to, it's such a small world, and when you're working in the clubs, you kind of end up meeting and getting to know, or like you said, take a class with Marilyn May, right?
Right.
And these people start to become more accessible, and you start crossing paths, and I crossed paths with Karen Mason, and I always mention her as a big influence for me, and she also has, I'm fortunate enough to have gotten to know her on a personal level, and she's somebody I consider a very dear friend, which is kind of an amazing thing about living in New York. You know, it's such a small world, because I certainly listened to her Broadway recordings before I came to New York. And she's another one with a big, you know, this great, gorgeous voice and somebody that I really can relate to as an artist, and somebody whose voice I just, you know, I can listen to her for hours.
Sure.
So, you know, it's kind of a broad range for me. And, you know, and then I was a big Janis Joplin fan. So, I mean, doesn't get broader than that.
And my, you know, I think of Janis Joplin, I tend to think of her either her voice being so, you know, raw.
Right.
I remember, this is one of these little memories that just popped into my head. When she was on the Ed Sullivan show.
Right.
Again, showing that I don't believe me when I say I'm 29. But, I remember very vividly watching, she came on Ed Sullivan, watching it with my parents, and my mother was so perplexed, both of my parents were very perplexed.
Right.
By, like, they didn't get her at all.
Right.
And then I always liked, of course, her probably most famous song, Me and Bobby McGee.
Right.
It's always interesting to me when somebody who is of a softer, let's say, singer. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that as an influence.
Well, I ended up, you mentioned in the introduction that I got to play, that I did a show called Beehive, and that is a show that is all about women singers of the 60s. And so one of the tracks that I got to cover in that show was a big set of Janis Joplin, where I got to play Janis Joplin. And I, certainly knew who she was, but I hadn't, like your mom, I kind of was a little perplexed until I really started to listen to her. And all of a sudden I really started to pay attention, and it just kind of started to get inside me. And I kind of tried to get a hold of everything I could of hers. And Pearl, I think I've listened to a million times. There's something about the way she embodies her music, and like you said, this raw, but it's this pure abandonment that she has. There's no fear. There's just a total commitment to what she's trying to communicate, regardless of, what it looks like, what it sounds like, how it comes across. And I think that there's a longing and a power in that that resonates, and that resonated with many, many thousands of people to make her the star that she became. And it's just, if she could, what we try to accomplish in a cabaret room, I talked about that intimacy and that feeling like you were getting to know somebody.
Mm-hmm.
She could sort of do that on stage with an audience of 20,000 out in the field listening, she's remarkable. And that fearlessness on stage, that power and that commitment, that was a real draw for me, for sure.
Did you ever see her on YouTube? You can find an entire show she did with Dick Cavett on television.
I did see that, and I'm blanking on it a little bit, but yeah, it's been a while since I've gone through some of those clips.
It's very interesting because she almost like vibrated.
I remember her sitting there. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely. She was always sort of vibrating on her own, frequency, a little above the rest. A little out of sync, and yet really standing out in a powerful way. And then she would talk about how she could, have this. One of her famous quotes is, on stage, I make love to 25,000 people and I go home alone. And really had this dichotomy of drawing in the masses into what she was doing, and then being known to be a lonely person as well. It was just remarkable to me.
But I want to circle back a little bit, because you'd mentioned that Kay Ballard was her version of, did you say My Man? Did I hear that?
Yeah, she did a whole. That's right. She did a whole album of Fannie Bryce material.
And then you, when I recently saw you at the Metropolitan Room in New York, and you did a several Fannie Bryce songs. And you're telling me that Streisand was a big influence. And one of the things that really struck me about you is that you took some songs that are so identified with very specific singers, where you might say a Streisand song. Sinatra song, where the singer did not write the song, and yet you think of it as their song. And you took a song that was so identified, and found your place for it that was nothing like theirs, and showing on an entirely different perspective, which kind of opened my eyes to that possibility that you don't necessarily have to be married to that favorite version.
Right. And it's hard because, we fall in love with a song for a variety of reasons, but certainly the recording of a particular song is a big part of that. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who loves Streisand's version of My Man, for example, it's not just the song they loved. It was her rendition that they loved.
Sure.
It was her rendition that they knew, and so it's so identifiable. And the rendition that we did was closer to the way Kay sang the song. She sort of very purposely sang it. It was much more square and
mm-hmm.
Much more straightforward. And Fanny Brice sang it that way. I mean, I have a recording of Fanny Brice singing it that's just gut-wrenching. And without the sort of amazing dynamic that Streisand is known for, that she executes brilliantly. And those are hers, and we wanted to treat the song really just as the song itself and the power that existed in the simplicity of what was there musically, but also in that lyric, which is quite a powerful lyric. I really, and I was hesitant. You know, we first did it years ago when we were putting together the Kay Show for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And we had that whole set that you heard in that show was part of that special opening night. We did a two-act version of the show, and that was part of it. And we made a real point to change that arrangement. But it was scary to do so. It's you know, it's tough to take songs that are so iconic. Because sometimes it, you know, works out beautifully and people appreciate your arrangement of it. And other times, you know, an audience has a harder time getting past not hearing what they're expecting to hear. And those are kind of the risks you take as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You don't always know what's going to land until you put it out there and see what happens.
Well, you know, I really felt also that your background in acting
mm-hmm.
played a large role in how you delivered that, so that
sure.
I got this. You know, the story, because for me, a lot about what music is about is the story, the emotion, the message, the words are to me actually more important than the melody.
Yeah.
For me personally.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. It means a lot to me to know that what I'm trying to communicate, you know, is coming through, or that people are able to hear it in. Even in through their own story,
mm-hmm.
and I appreciate hearing that. I think, you know, going back even to your question of what is cabaret, that's something that people talk about a lot is the lyric, and that was hard for me because I was always kind of music first. I mean, like I said, there's a reason we fall in love with certain things, and I loved everything that Streisand was doing, and I love a haunting melody, and I love a beautiful piano arrangement,
mm-hmm.
All the Michel Legrand stuff. If, you know, the Bergmans wrote some really wonderful lyrics, but some of the scores that he set to those are just so, so gorgeous. And I certainly fell in love with a melody for a long time. And it took me sort of rethinking to start to wrap my head around a lyric first and foremost. And I think they both go together.
Oh, absolutely.
You need a love of both of them for sure. But it was a freeing thing actually as an artist to be able to really embrace the lyric. It was a freeing thing musically, interestingly enough.
Can you repeat that last line?
It's kind of freeing to be able to really embrace the lyric, but it ends up being freeing musically as well, interestingly.
Oh, well, tell me more about that.
Just, you know, you stop being married to when you stop sort of being about what's happening in the piano, for instance, and you let that instrument do its job, and then you can kind of have this freedom to lay over it this melody line interpreted in the way that, you know, you're hearing the lyric, and it starts to soar musically as well, and the two parts kind of come together and complement each other, as opposed to one being sort of washed into the other, which I've seen happen.
Mm.
So, I love it. I love digging in.
Well, I want to, what like informs your choices, both in terms of the material and how you are approaching a song?
That's a good question. It depends, I suppose, on the song and what I'm looking for. I usually spend some time sitting with the lyric and kind of going through it again and again and trying to sort of figure out what it is that I'm trying to say. And that will certainly inform my choices in terms of phrasing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it all kind of is part and parcel. I think that ends up informing my choices. When I have an idea of what it is that I'm trying to say or communicate, that'll start to inform my musical choices as well. Whether I feel that something is big and belty or if I want to take something and really reduce it to something very quiet, it's definitely, I think it's lyric first. I think that informs me first.
And then from there, now who arranges your songs?
I work with a few people, actually, so it kind of depends on what I'm doing. You
mm-hmm.
know, when I say that, and I'm thinking about the fact that I also have, you know, I did a blues show with my friend Tracy Stark, who does a lot of arrangements for me, and I did a 70s show. And definitely in some of those, I mean, there's something about a great blues groove that just gets inside you that certainly also informs your choices. So it kind of depends on what kind of music you're looking for. But when it comes to the more sort of rock and blues stuff, Tracy, who plays the show that you saw,
yes,
she does a lot of arranging for me. My director, Barry Kleinbort, does a lot of arranging for me, and he works very closely with whatever musical director I'm working with. He and that musical director and myself, the three of us, will often collaborate on what we want that song and that arrangement to be. So, and as a director, I do that as well. So I definitely have a lot of input in my arrangements in terms of sort of the nitty-gritty musicality of it and the chord structure and the grooves and all of those wonderful things I will leave to the expertise of the musical director. But in terms of dynamics and structure of the arrangement and all of that, I do a lot of that myself and or do a lot of collaborating on that.
And tell me about this, the blues show that you did.
The blues show, we first did that in 2009, and it was an all-women band, and I got the whole band back again, which was very exciting, and we redid it again this past April. And the title song was Almost Blue. I like having themes that are a little broader so I can kind of leave myself room so not everything had to be blues. It was mm-hmm. Almost Blue. But it certainly had a fair amount of either blues, like a true blues, like Stormy Monday, one that I wrote myself with Tracy, and then some stuff that either had a gospel-y theme or a blues theme. We, for this year when we revamped the show, we took, we did this blues medley that was definitely an R-rated medley. it was all stuff that we pulled out of, like off of YouTube and old recordings, and all these recordings were from the 20s and 30s. And it was really quite something. It was the other side of the blues world. So we had a lot of fun with it.
Well, you know, when I listen to those old blues songs from the 20s,
yeah.
and I hear lines like, you know, references to things like Tootsie Roll and
yes.
shaking
yes.
you know, peaches off the tree. And,
yes.
and they,
Jelly
these are all
Roll. Ain't nobody going to take that
of
my Jelly Roll. That was a big one.
Yeah, well, there's Jelly Roll Morton, and which is like lewd name for a store. But
yes.
we wouldn't even
yes.
notice that today, probably.
Right, and that certainly ended up in the, I don't know. You know, when I did that medley, my mother was in the audience. I was a little worried about it, but she made it through. Even some of that stuff from the 20s left, It left a few people gasping, but it was good fun.
There's a band, a blues band I saw many years ago. I think they're still around, and it was called the Papa Chubby Band.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy who led the band, he called himself Papa Chubby, which is, you know, I'm not going to spell it out, but most of your kids out there could probably figure it out, kind of like Jelly Roll and Tootsie Roll. And,
Absolutely. It's funny the stuff they were getting away with or not getting away with. I don't know that these were necessarily the songs you were going to find on the jukebox.
They did for a while, and then, you know, people like, not Betty Boop, but her Helen Kane, and the kinds of things that you would see, and then they started to have to have this little code, because those things were being played in the movie theaters, and that's when they came up with all those codes and all censorship.
That's right. I don't know. This is very innocent, absolutely. I don't know what you were thinking. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I'm thinking of tissue rolls because I was a kid, you know, and you know, we just had trick or treat.
Of course.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, that's the ticket.
Too, right? Yeah.
So did the song "Good Thing Blues" come from the show?
It did. So it came from the first time we did the show. We did it again this year. And Tracy had said to me, I said, we got to have at least one reel. I don't think we did Stormy Monday at that time. And I said, we got to have at least one reel kind of traditional 12-bar blues. And she said, well, what if we write our own? And I said, okay. So she came up with the hook, Just Can't Get Enough of a Good Thing. And I wrote the rest of the lyric. And what ended up happening was we finished the song and she just plays what I sing, and it comes together beautifully. And we get into the band rehearsal, and she hands me the chart, or she's emailed me the chart to print out for the band. And the chart was called 13 Bar Blues. And I said, why is it a 13? What are you talking about? She said, Gretchen, you wrote a 13 Bar Blues. I said, well, that's not possible. I said 12 lines of lyrics for each verse. First of all, most blues songs, right, where they have like maybe two sentences per verse.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote 12. And, you know, so it's a very wordy blues. And then, so she goes through, plays the whole thing, and then there's this one extra bar. And I said, well, that doesn't count. That's like transition to get back to the top of the verse. She said, no, Gretchen, that counts. You wrote a 13-bar blues. Okay. So we lovingly
call it
the 13-bar blues.
You could also call it the Baker's Dozen Blues.
Yes. There you go. I like that.
Yeah.
I'm going to change it. I like that. That's good.
Baker's Dozen Blues. That's right. That's
perfect.
Yeah. So I just happen to have a copy here of Good Thing Blues. And it's a good thing I do because...
good thing.
It is because one of the rules here on Blog Talk Radio is I can't play the usual kinds of music, but I can play your song. It's really kind of cool.
Yeah.
And also,
cool.
I can also
Thank
play,
you.
If you want to do really old songs, every year we have new songs entering the public domain. I think we're up to 1922 or 3.
Okay.
So within 7 years, we're going to be hitting the main stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. God, that's
yeah,
crazy.
We can make all kinds of albums. And
Love it.
But until then, I'm going to play a song by you.
Cool.
And at the end of the show, by the way, I'm going to play this going out, and I think I'm going to play along with it because I can't help myself.
Love it. I love it.
Okay. I don't know if anybody will hear me, but I'm going to enjoy myself. So here is Good Thing Blues.
Just never worked out right. See, my life's been kind of rough, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. See, what I want, gotta have it now, and always seem to lose it somehow. I just can't hang on to a good thing. Well, I have me a lover. Well, okay, I've had a few. Love me something fierce, but then broke my heart in two. But I kept on looking for love, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. good thing. Well, I got me a great job and I made a lot of money. Got a nice big swank apartment with my pretty little honey. Kept on buying lots of stuff, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. Then the market tanks, my credit's maxed, ain't no money left to pay the tax, 'cause I spent too much of a good thing. Starts out really hot, then it turns to pot. Starts out really swell, then you land in hell. Starts out a great song, and then goes on too long. At first you think, what luck? Then you say, what the heck? Had a quiet little life, thought I would be content. A beautiful wife and enough cash to pay the rent. Still my life seemed rough, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. Now I'm all alone, out on my own. Maybe I had too much of a good thing. See what I want, gotta have it now, and always seem to lose it somehow. I just can't hang on to a good thing.
Yes. Oh, that was live.
Cool.
Yeah, I heard a little
audience
there in the end.
Yes, it was. That was from our first. That was from our first performance of that show back in 2009. Yeah. Did you play along?
No, I'm going to do that on the end of the show, and when we go out, I'm gonna play it again, Sam. I'm gonna play it and play along with it. I was just kind of listening.
What are you gonna play?
I'm sorry. Oh, I'm gonna play a little guitar. I have a guitar here, and I'm gonna play some lead.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's great. That is an instrument that I love and never tried to pick it up a couple times, but. It's not my thing, but I love it.
I'm entirely self-taught. I'm pretty decent at it, and I have it's called the one I have here is called the Jim Dandy by Gretsch, which
by
is.
Gretsch. Well, then I should definitely be playing guitar.
Oh yeah, especially if you're gonna do some blues. And this is this guitar is designed for it's based on those imagine some couple of guys sitting on a porch down south. You know, having some lemonade and going, okay, let's do some blues, man. What do you know? Okay, well, I'll play along with my guitar. So it's that kind of guitar. It's a little bit small.
Yeah.
And it's a guitar you can just sit around and play all day. And I often have it just sitting there with me.
I don't know if you noticed when you came to my last show, the guitar that Tracy played in one number was this. It's this tiny little guitar, and she brings it to rehearsal, and it's like, what the heck do you have? And I guess it's called a vagabond guitar.
Well, this is kind of like, yeah.
It has gorgeous sound.
Yeah.
Is that
kind of like
what
this
it's
one.
Like? Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And I have this jumbo 12-string that I often play, which is huge,
oh, nice.
A big guitar. And I always say the 12-string makes you sound twice as good.
There you go.
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been hard to pick up.
With the 12-string?
Yeah.
Well, it's just harder to, a little bit harder to play because you have to really dig in. You know, and it was really fun playing lead on a 12-string because now you really...
Yeah.
But there was a guy, two people who made that famous, George Harrison from the Beatles.
Sure, yeah.
And Roger McGuinn. And they had the identical 12-string Rickenbacker.
Wow.
And that iconic sound of the 12-string rock and roll guitar, that's where that
right.
comes from.
That's pretty cool.
That's my little trivia for today.
That's pretty cool. I love it.
So you know what I'd like to talk about in our as we're getting towards the end? I'd like you to describe, this is more of like a technical question that is for somebody looking to go into a world like this. There's a term called setting a show. And... setting a show. I go, we need to
setting
set
a show.
Okay. So when you're first starting out and you're creating your first cabaret show? What does somebody do?
I think there's a few ways to go about it. Sometimes when somebody comes to me wanting to create a new show, sometimes they have an idea in mind already, a particular theme. I had a client that did a tribute to Carol Burnett a couple of years ago and knew that, so we knew that that really was going to be all music from her career. So we start with something like that. I had another client who wanted to do a show that was all movies, songs from the movies. And that one was a little broader. I mean, we sat down and it was, you know, make me a list of every song from the movies that you love. Sometimes when people are doing their first shows, I will tell them to just, you know, to just come in and make me a list of all the stuff that they really love or that they really want to sing. And let's start playing with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what ends up happening is the show will kind of present itself at some point. I had a client who last year we did a show and it was popular music based on classical themes, and he had a classical background. And when he and I first got together, you know, he had a bunch of ideas for stuff he wanted to do and a bunch of different songs that he loved. And this kind of theme wasn't anywhere, you know, on the horizon for us at that point. And when we went into the room with David Gaines, who played the show, and we started playing through all these things, and we started talking about, you know, Mark's musical background and his gorgeous legit voice. And this idea of all of these classical themes kind of came out of those rehearsals. So I think that there's no sort of tried and true way other than to, if he's got a very specific idea, we'll sit down and talk about the music that supports that idea for sure. But I like to let things kind of present themselves organically, and I find that the artist ends up feeling a real connection to their music that way.
Well, I know that I've been to a number of shows where I've gotten to learn things that I never would have thought about,
mm-hmm.
you know, like maybe a focus on a particular songwriter.
Sure.
Who I didn't even know wrote as much. Like, I went recently to Linda Cossett's show at the Don't Tell Mamas. Johnny Green.
Right.
The music of Johnny Green. And I'm like, I'm
right.
familiar with Johnny Green, but
yeah.
I want to tell you that out of her entire show, I only knew of maybe two songs.
Yeah, I only knew a few of those as well. And
some of them were songs that
I
think Seal was the only one who did them ever, maybe.
Right.
Aside
right.
from Johnny Green.
Right. I saw that show too, and I thought that it was that even her patter and the information that she had about him was rather fascinating. That's a good show. It gets you not just to listen to these tunes, and of course, because there are some that we definitely know, we can have that moment as an audience member where we're kind of going, "Oh yes, that one," and it's kind of this cool thing to be able to identify it. But at the same time, we're learning things that are interesting about this composer. So, and at the same time, what was strong about that show is that I thought Linda was very much a part of it, as opposed to it all being just about the composer.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely understood why it resonated with her, and there was still a lot of her in that show, and that's always a big thing for me as both a director and an audience member. That's one of the things I'm kind of looking for, is because I want to know who that artist is as well. I thought she had a good blend of both. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And you're on a bunch of different ends of this business. You're a performer, director. You teach. So tell me, give me a short list of the things that you do, and then we're going to talk about how people can find you and what you're up to next.
I teach voice, and I also teach a weekly cabaret class. That's a very sort of open, casual, open to anybody kind of class on Sundays. And then I also direct people's cabarets in terms of my own. I got myself doing a lot of performing this year because I was doing a lot of teaching and directing and not as much performing in the last couple years ago. And I've been making myself get out there and perform a lot this year as well. So, yeah, I think those are the three big things: teaching, directing, and performing for me.
That's great. So, and where can people find you?
The best way to find me is to go to my website, which is just GretchenRyanHagen.com. And I have a studio page with information about the teaching and contact information there. And I tend to bounce around to a couple of studios in Midtown when I work. So it's people can reach out to me, and I will get back to them directly and go from there. That's kind of the best way.
Okay, great. So you may not know this, but people have listened to this from all over the world, because once we're done, this becomes a podcast, and I've had people contact me from anywhere from California to Saudi Arabia, believe it or not. I've had all kinds of interesting listeners who have contacted me about this show. So you never know. It will be on iTunes in a few minutes after the show is over. So let's talk about, you have another show at coming up at the Metropolitan Room this week.
Yep.
And
yep.
Also, if you could just give me your, like, what's the whole connection with that room around what you're doing at this moment?
The room, I've played a few times. A few of the shows were originated in that room. And they had approached me about bringing back the Kay Ballard show. And I had this idea to sort of bring back a few of the shows, and Joseph Macchio is one of the booking managers there, and I talked about this, and I decided I wanted to do this entire series this year of all shows from my past, so some of which happened at the Metropolitan Room, some were introduced at the Duplex or Don't Tell Mama, but they've all been presented again in 2015. We started in April. And this show, we did a different show each month. We did the blues show, then we did Kay Ballard in May, and then I did a 70s show in June, and then we took the summer off and came back with Both Sides Now. And then coming up on Thursday is the last big full show, which is a show I did, one of my first shows called How About Them Apples, and it's just me and piano, which is David Gaines, and it's more comic, and a lot of stuff about sort of those pesky little things that kind of bug us or annoy us or just make us say, "How about them apples?" which was something my grandmother always said. I say it all the time. So it felt like sort of the perfect name for the show.
Is there a song by that name? And if not,
there should be. We should write that.
Yeah.
All right. We'll talk about that.
Absolutely. I would like to hear that, and maybe a couple of Apple songs, and we can have it on Apple Records,
yeah.
You know.
I love it. So we're doing that on Thursday at 7, and then on December 2nd, we're going to do a recap show of the entire series, which is going to be crazy because it's all three musical directors, the entire band, anyone who's been in the band at some point is a part of this show on December 2nd.
That sounds like the stateroom scene from A Night at the Opera.
Yes, exactly.
And somebody opens up the door and everybody falls out. And who gets to play Margaret Dumont? That's what I want to know.
That's right. And you've seen the size of the Metropolitan Room stage, so.
Yes, like, that's why I kind of am thinking that.
Have the clown part going on, but we're gonna make it work and give you the cliff notes of the entire Reinhagen Redux series.
I like that. That's great.
That's going to be fun.
So we are in the last few minutes of the show. So is there anything else you would like to share with us before we go? And then I'm gonna play your song again and pick up my guitar.
Well, I look forward to hearing your guitar. I think come see the show if you're in New York. I would love that. And I really
well, I'm definitely coming. I'm there.
Yeah, that's cool. That's cool. I look forward to seeing you. And just thank you. It's been a lot of fun to talk to you. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks. And if anyone listening, remember, you can go to Gretchen's webpage. This is listed on my show page. You can just click on it, GretchenReinhagen.com. Come to the show if you're in New York. And you also get, for no additional charge, you get to meet Coach Andrew Porritt.
That's awesome right there.
And again, you can find out more about me at myfuturecoach.com. By the way, are you on Twitter?
Yes. Yep. G. Reinhagen.
Okay, G. Reinhagen. Okay, so I'm going to follow you.
Okay.
And then I'm going to play with you right now because we're going to go back back to the radio part here, where I get to play a little song called Good Thing Blues. Thank you so much, Gretchen, for being my guest.
Thank you, Andrew.
And thanks to Richard Skipper for making this happen.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Just never worked out right. See, my life's been kind of rough, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. See, what I want, gotta have it now, and always seem to lose it somehow. I just can't hang on to a good thing. Well, I have me a lover. Well, okay, I've had a few. Love me something fierce, but then broke my heart too. But I kept on looking for love, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. I fall in love, she's the one for sure, and before I know it, she's out the door. That ain't nearly enough of a good thing. Well, I got me a great job, and I made a lot of money. Got a nice big apartment with my pretty little honey. Kept on buying lots of stuff, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing. Then the market tanked, my credit maxed, ain't no money left to pay the tax, 'cause I spent too much of a good thing. Starts out really hot, then it turns to pot. Starts out really swell, then you land in hell. Starts out a great song and then goes on too long. At first you think, what luck? Then you say, what the heck? Had a quiet little life, thought I would be content. A beautiful wife and enough cash to pay the rent. Still my life seemed rough, 'cause I just can't get enough of a good thing.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and good night.